This week we have here the one parsha of Behar. And of course, the beginning of the parsha of Behar deals with the mitzvah of Shemitah. It's very interesting to see how the psukim present the mitzvah. If we would say it in our words, what's Shemitah? 6 years, you're on the land. 7th year, you get a Torah-endorsed and enforced sabbatical. The Pasuk says, at the beginning of Perek Kafhei, most of this week's Parsha is Perek Kafhei, with the exception of the final two Psukim. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe b'har Sinai le'mor, that is the famous Shemitah Esel Har Sinai. Daber o b'nei Yisrael v'omartar lehem, Kisavo el ha'aretz, when you come to the land, asher ani nosei nochem, v'shavaso ha'aretz, Shabbos Hashem, the land, sharest, Shabbos, freshim. Next, sheishanim tizvah sadecha, for 6 years you should sow the field, sheishanim tizvah kamecha, 6 years in the vineyard, v'asavta estivu asa, gather the produce, pasuk dalet uvashono hashviz, Shabbos, Shabboson, yihyeh la'aretz. So it's interesting that Shemitah has been mentioned twice, in Pasuk Beis, firstly, and then in Pasuk Dalet. It brackets the 6 years. The less intuitive mentioning of Shemitah, of course, is the first one, because it's actually not Lefi HaSeder. The way we described it, which is correct, is that Shemitah is the 7th year. So first you have the 6 years, then you have the 7th year. The correct Seder, so to speak, is first Pasuk Gimel, Sheshanim, and then Pasuk Dalet, Vashana Hashivias. Why then does the Torah mention Shemitah, the rest, before it actually mentions the first 6 years of work? That's an interesting Shaila. You can't have Shemitah before the first 6 years. And the Mefarshim explain, and I think it's very important, the themes behind Shemitah. What are they? It's very interesting because we are familiar with the division of mitzvahs into Ben Adam Lamakom, Ben Adam Lachaveiro, and from a certain point of view, at least practically, never the twain shall meet. They're two distinct, of course the twain do meet and they should meet, but they are distinct categories. Shemitah is because it actually accrues and belongs to both categories. Shemitah belongs to the category of Bin Adam Lamakom, and also to the category of Bin Adam Lachavira. How so? Well, Bin Adam Lamakom, of course, is the resting from the land. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, the land is mine, and that's really us in our relationship with Him. It's about working the land, not working the land, recognition of Hashem's ownership of the land. That's very much Bin Adam Lamakom. And it brings with it other Bin Adam Lamakom themes. It's about bitachon, it's about manocha bashana hashviyas, should you ask, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that he will provide. That's very much Ben Adam Lamakom. However, as the Sefer HaChinuch points out, it is also Ben Adam Lachaveiro. For as we know, the field is left fallow, the produce of the field is hefker. As the Pasuk says in Mishpatim, which is the Torah's first mentioning of Shemitah, Parshas Mishpatim, back in Shemos, Vashvi'is tishmetena unatasha, leave it, abandon it, meaning it's there for everyone, which is really an amazing Ben Adam Lachaveiro situation, whereby the fruit in your field is available for all, kol dich ben yesev yechol, for an entire year. That's Ben Adam Lachaveiro. Says the Sefer HaChinuch, what's the goal of Shemitah? Which is an interesting follow-on question, having detected the themes of Shemitah. What's the goal of Shemitah? And the Chinuch says something, it's so simple, but once he says it, it's compelling and important. To instill these ideas within us, these values. To instill the value of bitochon, a year not working the land. I mean, that's a year of bitochon training. A year of sharing liberally all of what used to be your field's produce with anyone who wants to come. That's a year of chesed training. says the Chinuch, it shouldn't end with Shemitah. It should stay with you for the next 6 years. That's a very important perspective. In other words, Shemitah, it's very different than the other years, but it shouldn't be separate from the other years, as if to say what happens in Shemitah stays in Shemitah. You have bitachon for one year out of seven, you're kind and generous for 1 year out of seven, but as soon as you make Havdalah at the end of Shemitah, it's back, you've got 6 years and you're the lord of the manor again. No, says the Chinuch, what you've spent a year developing, that should stay with you for the next 6 years. It's very illustrative from that point of view to compare the Shabbos Haaretz of Shemitah with what we call Shabbos every week. For we have a very similar theme. There's a famous discussion in the Gemara of a person who's wandering in the desert and he has no idea what day it is. But anyway, even in the city. But he doesn't know what day it is, so the Gemara is insistent that as much as he doesn't know which day is Shabbos, but he's got to mark Shabbos. You can't go 7 days without Shabbos. It just can't be. Now, he can't keep Shabbos every day, otherwise he'll never get anywhere. But he has to mark one day as Shabbos. And the question is, which day? I mean, the point is he doesn't know. And it's a machlokas in the Gemara, in the seventh parak of Shabbos. Some say, well, wherever you are, you have no choice. Count 6 days, and then the seventh is Shabbos. What are you going to do? Until you get to civilization, or its equivalent, and then you can keep the Shabbos that everybody else is keeping. 6 days, travel, then Shabbos, rest. Others say exactly the opposite. Keep today as Shabbos. You don't know, today is Shabbos. And then travel for 6 days. So the Gemara explains that actually you can appreciate the background to both. On the one hand, Shabbos is day seven because HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world for 6 days, and then on the seventh day, Vayanach Beyom HaShvi. On the other hand, in human experience, says the Gemara, Shabbos was the first full day because Adam was created halfway through Friday. So his day one, in a sense, as a full day, was Shabbos. So maybe it should be your full day. The Shemi Shmuel of Sokachov explains that, of course, practically you can only do one. But essentially, they're both correct, as if to say there's room for both. Really, what we're being told here is that Shabbos is both the end and the beginning of the week. That is to say, in physical terms and in restorative terms, it's the end. You've been going for 6 days, the seventh day you rest. But on the other hand, and from a certain point of view, no less important, it's the first day of the week. It's the beginning of the week. Should shed light on the rest of the week. A good Shabbos should lead to a Shabbostic a week for the next 6 days. It's the end of the week and the beginning. And that's really what the Chinuch is telling us with regards to the mitzvah of Shemitah. It's the seventh year, but it's also the first year. It's the first year in the sense that it should cast its light over the next 6 years. They should be Shemitah elevated, Shemitah inspired. And Mefarshim say, that's why the Torah actually mentions Shemitah first and last. Pasuk Beis begins with Shemitah. You haven't even had six years yet. But it mentions Shemitah because it's all about Shemitah. It is the beginning of the next six-year cycle. Shemitah is the tachlis, and therefore its lessons are so important. It's mentioned first as the beginning of the next 6 years, and then, of course, it's mentioned again as the culmination of those after those 6 years, culmination of the seven-year cycle. So I think that's a wonderful perspective because it takes Shemitah, it releases it from 1 year out of seven, and essentially it casts its light on the whole seven. Important also for us. Our Shemitah experience in the urban setting is about which makolet you shop in, essentially. So the issues of bitachon and of generosity and benevolence and all of those, they could become lost on us. Perhaps we need to pursue them, make sure they don't get lost in the shopping cart. So having introduced, and the Torah itself introduces the mitzvah of Shemitah, I would like to embark on a very fundamental discussion with regards to Shemitah nowadays, specifically, and to discuss two questions which are very much connected. The first question is, what is the status of Shemitah in our times? Of course, Shemitah in the Torah is from the Torah. Has anything changed? What is its status nowadays? And the second is, what are the implications and the general discussion with regards to what is known as the Heter Mechira? Now, that's very much in Yonah de Yoma. It's a very topical theme. We will, within the context of our parsha here, be discussing the principles and the background, right? The classic understanding of what's behind it in terms of halacha lemaisa. So that's not really for the forum of this year. One of my daily brachas is Shiloh Asani Posek. So, but to appreciate exactly where it comes from, and to then to get a sense of the sides of the discussion. So we begin at the beginning. If we ask Shmita in our times, is it on a Torah level? Is it on a Derabbanan level, the Oraisa or Derabbanan? That's the first question. And interestingly, we should note that this question can be addressed, number one, in a general way, within the general discussion of what we call mitzvahs hatluyos ba'aretz, land-based mitzvahs in Eretz Yisrael. But it also might be actually a very specific Shmita discussion. Shmita may actually have its own destiny, as we will see. So we'll begin with the general. As mitzvahs hatluyos ba'aretz, if we ask the question, are they applicable on a d'oraisa level nowadays? Well, the background to that, as we know, is that, amazingly, these mitzvahs need to be activated. The kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, the aspect that generates the obligations of these mitzvahs, truma and maaser and the like, and shmita, comes from the presence, a significant entry of presence of the Jewish people into Eretz Yisrael. It happened twice. Firstly, in the time of Yehoshua, and secondly, when we came back again, what the Gemara calls Biyashnia, translating literally into second coming, which is not exactly what we're talking about, that's in the time of Ezra. Now, it's clear to the Gemara in a number of places that the Kedusha that was bestowed on the entry of Yehoshua expired with the first Golus. It lasted as long as we were there, and when we were sent to Bavel, exiled to Bavel, it expired. It had to be renewed. In the words of the Gemara, Kidsha l'sha'ata, it was there for its time, v'lo l'asid lavo, but not for all time. The question is, however, what about the second time round? Is it the same? When we came back with Ezra, is it also only for that time? With the exile into Rome, it also expired? Or perhaps did it stay? And that is the question of the Gemara. Kidsha l'sha'ata, v'lo la'asid lavo, like the first one, or yes la'asid lavo. It's a machlokas in the Gemara. However, according to, shall we say, most authorities, the second one was permanent. That's very interesting. The first one was only for its time, the second one was permanent. According to those authorities, the Eretz Yisrael yet has the kedusha that was bestowed upon it or activated when we came back in Ezra. And therefore, that's the first point. It sounds like, in those terms, general terms, all mitzvahs apply completely on a d'oraisa level, land-based mitzvahs, because the kedusha is still there. That's the simplest understanding. However, we come now perhaps to look at Shmita by itself. Perhaps Shmita has its own status. And the reason why is because the pasuk in Parshas Re'eh, and Shmita is discussed also in Re'eh, says, V'zeh devar ha-shmita shamot. Now, without even going into to the rest of the pasuk, we see there's a double reference of Shmita. Zeh devar ha-shmita, one, shamot, two. And Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is quoted in the Yerushalmi as responding to these two Shmita shamots. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi explains that actually the pasuk is talking about two types of shmita. I didn't know there was two types of shmita. There are. They're in our parsha. One is shmita, and one is yovel, which is the super shmita. And Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi explains in the Yerushalmi that the pasuk is linking them to equate them. Their destiny is entwined. One follows the other. If you have yovel, then you have shmita. If you don't have Yovel, you don't have Shmita. Well, do we have Yovel? Now, as we know, we don't. And the reason why is based on Pasuk Yud of our Parsha. Let's take a look. For the Parsha goes from Shmita to Yovel. And it says, Vikidashtem eshnas hachamishim shana. You sanctify the 50th year, Yovel. Ukrosim deru shall proclaim freedom, ba'aretz lechol yoshveha. Yovel hi tiye lachem. And the significant words for us are the words kol yoshveha. All of its settlers, all of its inhabitants. The Gemara says in a number of places that Yovel only applies when most or all of the Jewish people are in Eretz Yisrael. Kol Yoshveha. If you don't have Kol Yoshveha Aleha, so there's no Yovel. If there's no Yovel, we saw from the Shemitah Yovel link, there's no Shemitah. And that is the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, which is an important opinion to know, that Shemitah, like Yovel, does not exist on a Torah level. Unlike Yovel, it exists on a Derabbanan level. There is no Yovel at all nowadays. The Derabbanan did not impose two consecutive years. But they did enact Shemitah on a Derabbanan level. So it sounds like, although, as we said, in a general sense, the Kedusha is there, but in a very specific Shemitah sense, because of this linkage to Yovel, Shemitah is not there on a Torah level. So says Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. That seems to be the end of the matter. Except, we mentioned that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's words feature in the Talmud Yerushalmi. Now, what does that mean for us? When you have a halachic ruling in the Talmud Yerushalmi, is that automatically the halacha? There's one important question that we need to ask. Namely, if there's ever a dispute between the Yerushalmi and the Talmud Bavli, the halacha follows the Bavli. Right? The majority of sages were in Bavel, and Talmud Bavli went for much, much longer. They had the hindsight, and they had everything. And if should there ever be a conflict between them, we will follow the Bavli. If there's no conflict, We're not adverse in policy to the Yerushalmi, which means the critical question whenever you have a Yerushalmi is, does the Bavli agree, or does the Talmud Bavli somewhere disagree? Well, does it or doesn't it? That's actually a dispute amongst the Rishonim. According to the consensus, the Bavli is also completely in line with this, in which case it's halacha. That Shemitah nowadays, because of the Shemitah Yovel link, is Derabbanan. That's the consensus amongst the Rishonim. We should note, for full disclosure, or broader disclosure, that the Ramban significantly understands that the Bavli disputes the Yerushalmi. We're not going to go into details as to where and how that is, but suffice it to say, as far as he is concerned, the Bavli disputes Yerushalmi. As far as the Talmud Bavli is concerned, Shemitah nowadays is also on the Oraisa level. And that's important, because the correct presentation of this question is, or the halachic position is, according to most authorities, Shemitah nowadays is Midrabbanan. According to some, that is to say, the Ramban, it is actually completely min haTorah, even nowadays. Okay, so that's a general discussion with regards to Shemitah, D'Oraisa, or D'Rabbanan. As we will see, it will have a good deal of bearing on the subject which is known as Heter Mechira. So let's move from there to Heter Mechira. What's the idea? Let's present it as if in the simplest way. The idea is to sell the land to a non-Jew, and thereby to remove the Kedusha, which would generate the mitzvah of Shemitah, mitzvahs even generally, and Shemitah perhaps amongst them, and thereby to essentially to continue to work the land as if there's no Shemitah. That is the question. And the significant questions that we need to ask about that is, number one, let's say such a sale could be effected. Would it work? Would it achieve that goal? That's question number one, the effectiveness of the sale. Number two, is it permissible to sell? Okay, so let's begin at the beginning. With regards to the first question, let's say the sale happened. Would it make a difference? Would it change anything halachically? Well, this question is actually discussed also in a number of places throughout the Talmud. The question essentially is, non-Jewish ownership of the land, of a field or more than a field, does that obviate that field and essentially exempt it from any of the mitzvahs hatluyos ba'aretz? In the words of the Gemara, yesh kinyan, or ein kinyan. Yesh kinyan lenochri, is it a significant acquisition to obviate it of these halachas? Or ein kinyan, the non-Jew owns it, that's very nice, or not very nice, depending, but it doesn't make a difference to the status of the land. And that's a dispute in the Talmud. Some say, ein kinyan lenochri, even if he owns it, nothing has changed. Of course, each side quotes a pasuk. Each side lays emphasis on a different source. Those who say, nothing has changed, quote the pasuk, ki li kol ha'aretz, Hashem says, ultimately the land is mine, meaning at the end of the day it's mine anyway, it doesn't make a difference who the temporal owner is, you or a non-Jew, ki li kol ha'aretz, li kedushas ha'aretz, it's up to me, says Hashem, and non-Jewish ownership won't make a difference. Others say, no, yesh kinyan ha'nochri, if the nochri owns it, all bets are off. There are no mitzvos hatluyos ba'aretz, and they quote the pasuk, interestingly, from Kriyat Shema. Ve'asavta diganecha means it makes a difference. Is it yours? Sorry, reishis digoncha. I'm sorry, not from Kriyat Shema. Reishis digoncha. Truma, for example. Reishis digoncha. It's got to be yours. But if the field is owned by a non-Jew, then there are no mitzvahs, not truma, and not any of the others. Okay. So that is an important question. And this question, interestingly, is a very old one. That is to say, not only is it in the Gemara, but the halachic debate now, who do we rule like? It goes back hundreds of years, because actually, this question was the subject of machlokas in Tzfat, in the 1500s, between the two great authorities of Tzfat. One of them was Rabbi Yosef Karo, who was the author of the Shulchan Aruch, and you wouldn't imagine anyone would argue with him, but his deputy on the Beis Din argued with him, his sgan, and he was the Mabit, Rav Moshe ben Yishaya Mitrani. And they were two chaverim on the Beis Din, and they argued this point. And Rabbi Yosef Karo was of the opinion that if a non-Jew owes the land, there's no mitzvah satluyos baretz. Yesh kinyan. The kinyan makes a difference. The Mabit said no. Ein kinyan. Now, Rabbi Yosef Karo explains himself. The reason why I say, and interestingly, there was no heter mechira. It's interesting to see how things are backwards now than how they used to be. We're wondering, could you sell the land? In the time of Rabbi Yosef Karo and the Mabit, no Jews owned any land in Eretz Yisrael. It was naturally, or as naturally as could be, was owned by the non-Jews. So that was the status quo. Really, their question was, do the halachas of Eretz Yisrael apply? All their food came from non-Jewish owned land. So what about that? So Rabbi Yosef Karo says, if the non-Jew owes the land, so it doesn't have that kedusha, for two reasons. Number one, perhaps we could say, yesh kinyan, again, that the non-Jewish acquisition makes a difference. And even if we're not sure about that, or maybe it doesn't normally make a difference, once again, there's a special Shmittah reason why it should make a difference. Important for us. And that is, if we take a look in Pasuk Vav, just to see how all of this comes from the Psukim, if we take a look in Pasuk Vav, it states, V'haysa Shabbos Ha'aretz Lochem Le'ochla. Should be Shabbos for the land, for you, la'achla. Now the word lachem is darshened in the Toras Kohanim. Lachem, says Toras Kohanim, v'la'akum. You and not akum, not non-Jews. Says Rabbi Yosef Karo, what does that mean? It means that regardless of your general policy for non-Jewish owned land, with mitzvahs generally, when it comes to Shemitah, the Torah says, Lachem velo la'akum. It's a specialized Shemitah teaching that it's only if the land belongs to you, velo la'akum. If it belongs to a non-Jew, so then there's no mitzvah of Shemitah. However, the Mabit argues. The Mabit is Ein Kinyan. Kinyan doesn't make a difference. What about Lachem velo la'akum? Doesn't that say that it makes a difference? Is it yours? Does it belong to you or non-Jew? Says the Mabit, no. That Toras Kohanim of Lachem Velo La'akum is not about ownership of the land if it generates the mitzvahs of Shemitah. It's coming for something entirely different. Lachem Velo La'akum, says Mabit, is about the permission to eat the produce of Shemitah. The Toras Kohanim is saying, Lachem Le'ochla. It's for you to eat. And not for Akum. It means there's many restrictions about Shemitah food. Be sure that it's eaten by Jews. It's a mitzvah to eat it, and should be eaten by Jews and not non-Jews. You could almost say, if you look at the pasuk carefully, that the word lachem is sandwiched between two words, ha'aretz and la'ochla. Which one is it coming to qualify? Ha'aretz, your land, or la'ochla, for you to eat? That's really the essence, the substance of the machlokas, Rabbi Yosef Karo and the Mabit. And this is about the general question, which is called Yivul Nochri. We haven't even gotten near to the Het HaMechira yet. Just generally, non-Jewish owned produce in Eretz Yisrael. Does it have the halachas of Shemitah? And this machlokas raged for 28 years between the Mabit and Rabbi Yosef Karo. It went for four Shemitahs, and it would have gone longer, except the Mabit passed away. It's the only thing that stopped him from arguing this point further with the Rabbi Yosef Karo. But the machlokas didn't go away, because the Mabit was succeeded by his son, Rabbi Yosef, the Maharit, who took up his father's position and continued to dispute the position of Rabbi Yosef Karo. So these two questions, or more correctly, these two sides of the question, Yevul Nochri, does it have Kedusha Shemitah or not, was not a machlokas between two towns, it was machlokas in town, in Tzfat, between Rabbi Yosef Karo and the Mabit, and later his son, the Maharit. We mentioned before that this question can be impacted by, if we say that Shemitah is D'oraisa nowadays, or D'rabbanan, how so? Well, the Vilna Gaon says that the whole discussion, based on Rishonim, the whole discussion as to whether non-Jewish ownership of the land, the mitzvahs of Tzluris Baritz apply, maybe yes, maybe no, says the Vilna Gaon, all of that is only with regards to mitzvahs on a D'oraisa level. If it's on a D'rabbanan level, all agree that non-Jewish ownership will obviate the land from those obligations. And that's very important, because we've noted that the consensus amongst the authorities is that Shemitah nowadays is D'rabbanan, which means, according to the Vilna Gaon, there's not even any question that non-Jewish ownership would make a difference. So that's important for the mix. And so, we may be familiar with this question in terms of much more recent names, or even places now. Where do they consider Yivul Nochri to have Kedusha Shviyas? Where did they not? Well, everybody knows that in Yerushalayim, or the original Minag Yerushalayim, is that Yivul Nochri doesn't have Kedusha Shviyas. The Minag of Bnei Brak, what is called, is that it does. How does that come to be? Because the Chazon Ish, who was Bnei Brak, essentially, he sided with the Maharit, that's all. In other words, it didn't begin 50 years ago. It began with Rabbi Yosef Karo and the Maharit and the Mabit. The Chazon Ish in Bnei Brak sides with the Maharit that Yivul Nochri doesn't make a difference, it still has Kedusha Shviyas. Whereas the Minag, Yerushalayim, and in fact the Minag in all of Eretz Yisrael, really, is recorded as being in line with Rabbi Yosef Karo. Okay, so thus far we have discussed the question of would the sale make a difference? That is to say, Heter Mechira, pardon the expression, can only get off the ground if you understand that it's an owner, a non-Jew, there would be no mitzvahs of Shemitah. If it wouldn't make a difference, then selling wouldn't make a difference. So you have to side with Rabbi Yosef Karo that it would make a difference even before you get to the question of can you sell? And that brings us to the question of can you sell? This actually is possibly the most difficult area of the heter mechira. Is there a heter mechira? Is it mutter to sell? The background here is a pasuk in Chumash Devarim, which says, lo techanem. Lo techanem. Now, lo techanem, talking about our relationship with the nations who live in Israel. Now, lo techanem can mean a number of things. But significantly for us, lo techanem is darshan by the Gemara in Maseches Avodah Zarah from the expression chanoya. Chanoya, lahavdil, we call chanoya parking, but chanoya means to be there, to stay there. Lo titein lahem chanoya bekarka. Do not give them a foothold, do not give them a place to be here. And that becomes an isser to sell land in Eretz Yisrael to non-Jews. That's very interesting. That means it is a Torah prohibition. Well, if it's Aser, then there can be no Heter Mechira. So there's a number of ports open on this question now. Well, on the one hand, we're discussing, would it make a difference if you sell? Maybe you can't sell. And in fact, the Netziv, and everyone was involved in this discussion in the late 1800s when the question of Heter Mechira began. And the Netziv, in his tshuvas, the way that he phrased it was, Barach mi hazeev, upagai ta'ari, you're being chased by a wolf, but you ran headlong into a lion. In other words, what he means to say is, according to most authorities, Shemitah nowadays is derabbanan. Now you're looking to somehow navigate that, but in so doing, you're rushing headlong into a Torah prohibition. That's not a good solution for anything, certainly not for a derabbanan problem. That's the way that he phrased it. And indeed, unless we say something extraordinary, the linear reading of that Gemara yields the result that you can't sell. I mean, it's just very simply osur. So it's a non-option. Even if it would work, it can't be done. So those who endorse the sale, how do they explain? Well, the two classic defenses or justifications for the sale, the first comes from the Aderas. The Aderas was the father-in-law of Rav Kook, Rav Tu'umim, and Besof Yomav, he lived in Yerushalayim. And he explains that it's very reasonable, but the question is, does that make a difference? What does he say? Says the Aderas, why does the Torah say that you can't sell land in Eretz Yisrael to non-Jews? Because you shouldn't strengthen their presence in the land. But what if you're selling them land in order to strengthen your presence in the land? Well, that should be okay. The context of the pasuk is, you're coming in, they're there. If you sell them land, you'll give them a stronger presence. However, says the Aderes, it's to help the yeshuv. And again, the then-fledgling yeshuv, which they judged, or some judged, needed. It was very important for their survival, perhaps, on a certain level. Certainly as they were beginning to establish themselves to do this. And therefore, what would happen if selling land doesn't establish his position, but strengthens your position, the Jewish yeshuv? So then that would seem to be okay. As we said, it sounds eminently reasonable. However, the Torah didn't really say why you can't sell land. It sounds like the Aderes is into the territory of what's called Taima Dekra, reason for the mitzvah, because applying the reason for the mitzvah gives the opposite result. If you understand the reason for the mitzvah, here it will be okay to sell. We don't normally subscribe to that approach to halacha. But that was the explanation of the Aderet. To strengthen the yeshuv, he held there was no issur. The second, which is actually held by Rav Kook himself, and by the Toras Chesed, one of the great poskim also of late 1800s. It is interesting that the Torah, we say, you can't sell. There's a word for sale in Hebrew, it's called limkor. But the Torah doesn't say lo timkor. The Torah says lo techanein, which then becomes an expression of chanaya, chanaya bakarka. Is the connotation of chanaya exactly the same as sale? It's just about ownership? Well, Toras Chesed and Rav Kook explained that mechira, even if you own something for one day, it's been sold for that day. Chanaya means long-term or permanent. For us, chanaya be long-term parking, not short-term. And therefore, because the Torah says lo techaneim, that's actually responding to the word that way, the Torah is prohibiting selling it permanently. If you would sell it for a time, somehow it would be of a temporary sale or a short-term sale, that would not be a violation of lo techaneim. And indeed, Rabbi Yitzhak Kochan, inspector of Kovna, the posek of that time, posek hador really of that time, as he gave his support for the Heter Mechira, he stipulated that the sale should not be a permanent sale. It doesn't need to be a permanent sale, just a year plus change on either side, a short while before and afterwards, but that's of the essence. They felt that was not considered to be a violation of Techane. Okay, so these are really in broad strokes the issues. Interestingly, there was another issue at the time. I wonder if it's still an issue. Perhaps it is. Namely, the sale was not done in a way that was registered the way a normal land sale would be. It wasn't registered in what they called the tabo, the land registry. They couldn't afford to do that. So the last thing they want to do is tell the Turks or the British mandate afterwards that we're selling all of our land to the Arabs. So it would be halachic sale, but it wouldn't be registered. And now the question is that a problem? we come to the area of halacha which is called dina de machusa dina, whereby it could be that business transactions aren't really valid if they're not also ratified by the various temporal authorities, etc. That's dina de machusa dina. That's another question. The defense, interestingly, for that, and this is an issue that doesn't apply to mechiras chametz. You do not need to notify the government when you sell your chametz, but you'd want to notify them if you sell your house or your field. The defense, interestingly, was based on a Ran in Nedarim who says rather explosively that the din of dina de machusa dina, the requirement to follow the law of the land, does not apply in the land of Israel, because everyone owns the land of Israel. If you're a guest in someone else's kingdom, you're a guest in his house, you're a guest in his country, you got to abide by his rules. Eretz Yisrael, you're not a guest in anyone. You're a guest in God's country. His rules are the Torah. As you can appreciate, that's a statement that has been the beginning of many a lively debate. So, these are the highlights of the Heter Mechira. Just to note, even the Matirim, Rav Kook, who was of the Matirim, never gave a blanket Heter. That's important to know. As if to say, he assessed the situation anew with each Shmita, as he could, as if to say, it seems that we still need for this one Shmita Heter Mechira, but he was not prepared to say that it's Mutter as a blanket Heter. It was a Hora Ashar each time. And of course, the situation there, we have our own difficulties, but there, I mean, people, Mamish did not have food. That's also important to know. And secondly, it doesn't allow everything to be done to the land. There's many stipulations. There are details in terms of what exactly it allows to be done, and that also needs to be abided by. And it needs to be taken seriously by the farmers also. I mean, they'll sign the Heter Mechira, but there was a famous case or infamous case of the Arab who actually bought the land, who came to inspect his field, and they called the police for trespassing. So that's would also need to be, if it's a serious sale, it has to be taken seriously. In any case, this is the background to this very interesting Shaila, versus much more to say, but for us, we'll suffice it with that. Now, I'd like to come back to the way we began the discussion, which is the dual nature of Shmita. That is to say, it has an aspect of Ben Adam Lamokom, it has an aspect of Ben Adam Lachaveiro. And we noted that they're both there, and we left it at that. But I think it's important also to note that not only are they both present, they're connected. There is a certain synergy between the two. And I think it's very important because so often Ben Adam Lachaveiro, Ben Adam Lamokom, they're kind of pitted against each other a little bit. And one takes a pole position and one takes a second place, which of course is incorrect. But it's more than that. Not only are they equally important, but they empower each other. Ben Adam Lamokom elevates Ben Adam Lachaveiro. And the reason why is because a Ben Adam Lamokom vision, if it's faithfully and earnestly absorbed, should make a difference to the way a person relates to those around him. And actually, Shmita is a very good example. As we mentioned, there's two aspects to Shmita. Number one, a person leaves off working the land. Okay, that's Ben Adam Lamokom. Number two, his food is hefker. Why is his food hefker? His food is hefker because he left off from working the land. That is to say, the very Ben Adam Lamokom awareness that the land belongs to Hashem, which means, and therefore you can't work the land this year, is the very same awareness that in the end your food doesn't also really belong to you, so then it's shared equally by everyone. That is a level of giving that goes way beyond what we would normally call generosity. Typically, in order to be a giving person, you have to have what to give. And that's already called generosity. I mean, so someone approaches you, they're hungry, they have needs, etc. You give of your resources, it's very generous, but you're still the giver, you're still the owner, but it's still a good deed. It's an entirely different order of magnitude when it comes to Shmita. This time last year, if he says, "May I enter your field?" the Jewish response would be to say, "With pleasure, of course, help out." This year, it's to say, "It's not my field. I was just about to enter there myself." It's a level of chesed. There isn't even a giver. He's not even a receiver. He's a sharer. That's a complete nullification of the roles of giver and receiver. How could chesed be elevated to a position like that? These are very high madrigas. But what's important to emphasize is that it's funded and fueled by your Ben Adam Lamoka relationship with Shemitah. There's no way you could say that this food is hefker unless you realize first that it belongs to Hashem. So we see that the Ben Adam Lamokum awareness elevates possibilities to of Ben Adam Lachaber to things that wouldn't meaningfully be possible otherwise. Rare are the people who reached such a level of absolute abnegation. They say that Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, his house was a house of hefker. It was Shemitah permanently, constantly in his house. People could come and go, help themselves to whatever, and people stayed there, often for a while, wherever you could find a place, just bedded down and ate whatever was available. And actually, there were some people who didn't know who Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was. They didn't know who the Baal HaBayit was, because he just came and went like everybody else. In fact, there was someone who had been there for a couple of weeks. He was considering feeling uncomfortable. I mean, 2 weeks is already pushing a limit. So he asked the person next to him, he says, how long do people need to stay here normally? He didn't realize he was talking to Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the owner of the house. He said, I've been here a couple of weeks. Is that too much? I mean, no one told me to leave or anything. Can I stay here? And Reb Chaim Soloveitchik responded to him and says, well, listen, I've been here for years. No one's told me to leave. And it came from this sense of, what's my house for? My house is for people to be in. He really felt like he was just one of those people. No one knew who he was. So if you're a Chaim Soloveitchik, so you have that the whole time. But this is, I think, the full impact of the message of Shemitah. Ben Adam Lamokum should give you a vision for Ben Adam Lachavi. Interesting to mention in this vein, there is a mitzvah, that's in the Gemara, known as Mayim Acharonim. Different people have different minhagim about Mayim Acharonim, different minhagim or Mayim Acharonim, before you bench, you've had your meal, before you bench, the Mayim Acharonim. What's the background to Mayim Acharonim? Well, actually, the Gemara talks about it in two places. The famous reason for Mayim Acharonim is what's called Melach Sodomis, that very, very powerful salt that's around the region of Sodom. So someone got the idea to sell it. And it's dangerous. They used to have it in on the table because it would add this very potent flavoring to the food. But after the meal, you don't want any residue on your fingers. They would eat with their fingers. Because if it touches the eyes, it could blind you. Has anyone who's ever been in the Dead Sea? No. So wash your hands. That's the classic explanation, and it's to be found in the Gemara, in Maseches Chulin, in Daf Kufvav, Melach Sodomis, Mesame Es Ha'enayim. Okay? It sounds like it's pure a health concern. It's a practical thing. V'nishmartem od nashasekem, take care of your eyes, get rid of that salt. Okay. And that's why some say that if you don't have Melach Sodomis, then maybe you don't need to do Mayim Acharonim. Tosfos say that, it's different minhagim. But it's very interesting to note that that's only one of the two places where the Gemara talks about Mayim Acharonim. In Chulin, as we said. But in Maseches Brachos, in the end of the 8th Perek, Daf Nun Gimel, the Gemara gives an entirely different background to Mayim Acharonim. You wouldn't recognize it. The Gemara quotes the Pasuk, V'hiskadishtem V'hiyisem Kedoshim, which we've read recently. V'hiskadishtem V'hiyisem Kedoshim. Sanctify yourselves. You should be sanctified. Says the Gemara, as a kind of a derabbanon drasha, v'hiskadishtem, the first phrase, is mayim rishon. That's what, netilas yadayim before the meal. V'yisem kedoshim, is mayim achron. Now these, you couldn't ask for two more different approaches to this thing called mayim achronim. The one seems to be practical in the extreme, and the other is about sanctity, and wash your hands, and elevate your hands, and add holiness. Very, very different. Okay. Until Rav Kook comes along in his Sefer Einaya, which is Chidushi HaGodos on Maseches Brachos, and says that actually these two are the same. These are two ways of saying the same thing. Haketzad. How so? says Rav Kook, who is a generous person? And who is a stingy person? A stingy person is someone for whom the be-all and end-all of his existence is enjoying his assets. If all of his religious energies go into enjoying life and enjoying what he has, he will have a fundamental opposition to sharing with anyone else. Someone who has a slightly broader vision of what life is about, he has more of a bird's-eye perspective on his physical possessions, and he understands not what it's all about. And on the contrary, if you have, you give and you share. Sodom are famous for their stinginess. They took it to an extreme that's grotesque, whereby not only were they stingy, but they made stinginess mandatory. And they made generosity illegal. Ad kedei kach. Their entire legal ethos was funneled into this stinginess. So much so, when Lot took in guests, that the town was in an uproar. As we know from Parsha, they woke up. They got out of bed in the middle of the night. Because this is the end of the neighborhood. One person brings in guests. So it was moral outrage, which can be harnessed for anything, really. The Gemara tells us about Eliezer, Avram's servant, who paid a visit to Sodom. He had no idea what to expect. He did not know what was to happen. Someone came up to him, it's a new person in town, and hit him. And then sued him. In Sodom, the victim has to pay. He didn't know what to do. He took him to Beis Din, or the equivalent thereof in Sodom. And the judge says, he hit you, you've got to pay. So Eliezer, who wasn't really prepared to pay, so he took what for him was a very logical extension. He went up to the judge, he beat the judge, and said, it's okay, no need to pay me, you can just pay him direct. That's not what people normally mean when they talk about beating the legal system. So where does this come from? We know from Chazal, originally Sodom was such a lush and fertile area. It had such an abundance of natural goodness. Lot was drawn towards it. The pasuk says, and it was their undoing. They became completely obsessed with it. And they enjoying their resources became their reason for existence now. And the doors were shut to anybody else, and Aveiro Guerreras Aveiro until it became illegal to. What a way to live. Says Rav Kook, salt represents taste. It's got quite a pungent taste. And everyone needs a bit of tam in life. Even the very frugal diet of Pirkei Avos, Kachi Darka Shel Torah, it's bread and salt. It's not just bread. It's not for mineral value. Everyone needs a bit of something. Kachi darkish Torah, pas b'melach tocha. Salt is one of the. It represents the enjoyment of life, and that's okay. Unless enjoying life becomes the be all and end all, and that now becomes a concept which is called the salt of Sodom. The salt of Sodom, which is so strong and so all consuming. Because what happens when that becomes your whole reason for existence? Says Rav Kook, in the words of the Gemara, Misame es ha'inayim, blinds the eyes. You can't see anyone. You can't see anybody else. There's no room for anyone. You don't notice them. You don't care about them. Melach Sodom is Misame es ha'inayim. The salt of Sodom blinds the eyes. Means if your approach to enjoying life is so all-engrossing as it was for Sodom, it will impair your vision. You will not see the needs of the person next to you. That's a problem. And it's a problem that everyone needs to encounter as they engage in physicality. And the most basic physical activity is eating and drinking. But what's the antidote? Says Rav Kook, the antidote is the other Gemara. V'hiskadishtem, v'yisim kadosh, be holy. Be elevated. Have a higher vision of life. That's it. Life is just about the meal. if you have a higher vision of life, then all of this comes into perspective, and then melas sodomus won't be a problem for you. Your salt will be Torah salt, not Sodom salt. You'll be able to see people, because if you have, you give. That's what it's all about. And we see it. That there are those who have, but they have so much that there's not enough to give. There's nothing to give. And the whole mansion, doesn't work out for any room to be made available. There's only two of them, or one of them. And others who have chetzi gornished, and half of that half is yours. Because their perspective on life, is that what it's for? It's a wonderful explanation. And how the Achdus of Torah, really, these two sections of the Gemara, which seem to have nothing in common, they're synthesized. And the message for us is exactly the same. V'skadishtem means have a ben odom lamokom perspective. What are you here for? Your ben odom lachaveru will look very different. It's very interesting that last week, or 2 weeks ago, when we spoke about the Haftalah Recha Kamocha, and Rabbi Akiva famously says, Ze klal gadol b'Torah. And it sounds like, but after Rabbi Akiva said Ze klal gadol b'Torah, what else is there to say? I mean, could you respond to that? Could you top that? Amazingly, someone did. In the Toras Kohanim, the Toras Kohanim says, Omer Rabbi Akiva, Ze klal gadol b'Torah. And then, says Toras Kohanim, Ben Azai came along. Ben Azai, I think, was Rabbi Akiva's son-in-law. And said, there's a greater klal. Wow, we weren't aware there was a greater klal. There's a greater klal, says Ben Azai. Ze Sefer Toldos Adam. That's a reference to Bereishis, Perikei. Ze Sefer Toldos Adam, Betzelem Elokim Bara Oso. Who would have thought that anyone could say something after Rabbi Akiva? But Ben Azai says, the Haftalah Recha Kamocha, it's klal gadol b'Torah, no question about it. Is there any greater klal? Ben Azai claimed that there was. To view the person not only as a person with all the goodness that goes with that, but as a tzelem elokim. Your respect for another human being as a tzelem elokim is greater, as a higher level than v'haftalah recha kamocha. All of a sudden, everyone around you, but is a tzelem elokim. But that's a function of your elokim consciousness. If you don't have an elokim awareness, so then you don't have a tzelem elokim awareness. The notion of reverence for another person as a carrier of tzelem elokim. And once again, the ben odom lamokom vision of tzelem elokim within you spills out to others, and the way that you relate to others changes. Also, could I to mention, while we're having discussed the connectivity, really, between ben adam lamokom and adam lachavira, the same is true, important to note, the other way around. A person's relationships, ben adam lachavira, will affect his relationship, ben adam lamokom. Where do we find this? The Medrash Shmos Rabbah says that Paro, in the beginning of Shmos, what's his introduction? Vayakam melech hadash ha-mitzrayim, asher lo yada es Yosef. Doesn't know Yosef. So the Medrash says, really? How can you be the king of Egypt and not know Yosef? Everyone knows Yosef. What it means is, he didn't recognize Yosef. He didn't appreciate Yosef. He shut him out. He's not part of our, we don't owe him anything. Shelo yodas Yosef. says the Shmos Rabbah, today it says lo yada es Yosef. He doesn't recognize Yosef. Tomorrow it will say, Lo yadati es Hashem, which is what Paro said when Moshe confronted him. Hashem says, let the Jewish people, I don't know Hashem. Says Shmos Rabbah, why don't you know Hashem? Because yesterday you didn't know Yosef. In other words, many of the matters of recognition and of appreciation, of kindnesses and of considerations, our immediate surroundings are people. A person who becomes dulled and doesn't recognize, his recognition of Hashem is in jeopardy. Which is somewhat more abstract, and that's important for the connection between the two. Not only are they equal, but each one empowers the other. The more a person recognizes others, the more a person appreciates kindnesses, the more open he is. Because otherwise, all the forces behind his refusal to recognize others It's one step away from refusing to recognize Hashem himself. I'll conclude with a very interesting feeling. Kiddush Levana, which has so many aspects to it, and one of the things that we do is we say Shalom Aleichem to each other. It's interesting. I mean, you say so many different things, and one of them is Shalom Aleichem three times. What's that got to do with Kiddush Levana? You needed the moon to come out to say Shalom Aleichem. The Arizal says a most fascinating thing. We somehow were affected by what happened with the moon. And the Jewish people are like the moon. And we daven that the moon should be made whole again because the Jewish people would be made whole again. We're reflective of Hashem's light, like the moon is of the sun. It bothers us that the moon is impaired. And we're impaired. It's a force of nature. It's a very primal force of nature. If that's rectified, it's better for everyone. Better for us, better for the world. Why was the moon impaired? Well, as we know, for whatever it means, and Rashi quotes it, the moon was not prepared to recognize there wasn't room for anybody else. So the moon suffered as a result of that, because it was the moon that had to step down. Says the Arizal, once a month, as we daven that the moon should be made whole again with all that that represents, we also engage in something of a rectification of the moon's mistake. The moon wasn't prepared to recognize anyone else, so we should. So you daven for the moon to become bigger, and then you recognize the person next to you, and you say Shalom Aleichem. And I think that perhaps there's room to add a certain feeling here. Kiddush Levana is referred to by the Gemara as Kabbalas Pnei Hashchina. Ilmale Lezoch Yisrael Elahatbi Pnei Hashchina Avin Shashamayim. And that's why Kiddush Levana is typically said in Shabbos clothes. It gravitates towards Motzei Shabbos because people are wearing Shabbos clothes. Because it's Kabbalat Panim. It's Kabbalas Pnei Hashchina. Why is it Kabbalas Pnei Hashchina? So the Mefarshim explain, because it's in the end it's about the natural running of the world. And the lunar cycle is the most expanded of our regular cycles. We've got the daily cycle. And Kabbalah Pnei Hashchina means recognizing Hashem behind the world. That's Kabbalah Pnei Hashchina. Well, perhaps one of the reasons why we can't recognize the person next to us is because we don't recognize Hashem as being behind the running of the world. Because the working theory is default back to us running the world. Well, if I'm running the world, so then there's not really room for anybody else. But as soon as I give it back to Hashem, and the Kabbalah Pnei Hashchina, it's like the world is in good hands. It's in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hand. I'll get what's coming to me. He'll get what's coming to him. As soon as I'm a Kabbalah Pnei Hashchina, it enables me to look at the person next, to recognize him. There's room for him. And I'm able to say, if Hashem is running the world, I can turn to the person next to him and say, Shalom Aleichem. Once again, that connection between Ben Adam Lamachim and Ben Adam Chavir, and all of that stems, we've gone on a bit of a journey, but it's rooted back in Shemitah, these two aspects to Shemitah, that's really food for thought, not only for once in every 7 years, but for all the years in between, and all the days of which those years are made. We'll leave it over there.